Roosevelt played an instrumental role in drafting that document.
Well, yes, and the U.S. has in the past played roles of trying to mediate in some conflicts. We see the U.S. involvement in the agreements in Northern Ireland that stopped the fighting there. It's that in recent times, the U.S. has decided that it's going to, instead of ever trying to play this role of mediator in, of conflicts, it's going to play this role of choosing a side. That side is then the side that we nominate as the good side. And so in recent years, the U.S. has lost the ability to play that kind of a role. And wouldn't it be nice if we were able to get back to something like that? It's hard now to see the U.S. playing a role of peacemaker and mediator because we have a State Department that is so much an appendage of the Pentagon. You have somebody like Secretary of State Antony Blinken that is somebody who came out of a lobbying firm that was getting contracts for the Defense Department that has really shown himself to be somebody who is very much of the mindset that the U.S. can continue on this path of trying to be the hegemonic nation instead of playing the role that he's supposed to play, which is a role of diplomats. And diplomats talk to your adversaries. So he should be talking to the adversaries on a regular basis. And instead, in the case of Ukraine, for example, he has been traveling around the world trying to get countries to send more weapons to Ukraine instead of talking to countries around the world about how are we going to solve this conflict. When you see the number of times that he's met with his counterpart in Russia, Lavrov, since the war began, it is one time that there was a face-to-face meeting that was on the sidelines of the G20 meeting and lasted for all of 10 minutes. So it would be nice if we had a State Department that really put its efforts into peacemaking. You might recall when Denis Kucinich was a congressman how he wanted to have a Department of Peace, because the State Department does not play that role.
And China is pushing back. You know, they're no longer the easy target pushover that they had been for several centuries of being invaded and occupied by foreign powers. And in the case of Blinken, there was one high-ranking Chinese diplomat who said, "You have no right to lecture us about anything."
The Chinese came back very strongly, and I think that is a mark of the new era that we're in.
The Israelis' settlement project has continued apace. The colonization is increasing. Oppression of Palestinians by Israelis. It's three major human rights organizations, B'Tselem, which is an Israeli group, Human Rights Watch, and Amnesty International, have all said that Israel is practicing apartheid.
Obviously, with this new right-wing government getting worse and worse and becoming so embarrassing for the United States to be still giving almost $4 billion of our tax dollars every year to a government that is now have people inside the government that talk about wiping out entire villages. Of course, this is how the State of Israel was founded. But the fact that we don't even have people within the Congress, except for a handful of them, that are willing to stand up and even talking about conditioning some of that aid on Israeli practices. I mean, we would like to see the U.S. entirely cut the $4 billion that we're giving to Israel every year because it's being used in such an oppressive way. But even to broach the issue of how do you cut back on the U.S. money is a difficult thing to do in Congress. And that gets us back to the corruption of Congress, the money in Congress, the role of AIPAC, which is the strongest foreign policy lobby group in our country. And you see that people who, even when they are mentioning that they're going to run for Congress, are immediately visited by people from AIPAC to demand from them some kind of allegiance to the government of Israel. So while public opinion in the United States is changing very much about Israel, we still don't see that reflected in the policies of our Congress or the policies of the White House.
Well, we also see lobbies at work in terms of Cuba, guns, the NRA, the military-industrial complex that you mentioned as well. They do have an influence on policy.
Well, if you just take Cuba, you look at this small group of Cuban Americans who have created a lobby that they said is actually modeled after AIPAC. They looked at how effective AIPAC was, and they have created a lobby group that is its people from the diaspora in Cuba, mostly living in southern Florida, that have a stranglehold. And they have Bob Menendez from the Democratic Senate, and they have Marco Rubio from the Republican side, who really control the policies. And they control it in such a way that is devastating for the Cuban people. It's hard to imagine that these Cuban Americans really have any family left, because if they did, they would not be carrying out policies that so hurt the people who are living on the island. And this is true of U.S. sanctions against small countries, in which it's a form of collective punishment, and it really is a kind of economic warfare. In the case of Cuba, where I travel quite often, I've never seen conditions so bad since the time of the fall of the Soviet Union, because after COVID, the tourism industry has been devastated, and that was an important source of income for the island, and because the Biden administration has followed the path of Donald Trump instead of going back to the path of Obama, which was one of opening up relations. And you see these terrible sanctions, as well as Cuba being on the state sponsor of terrorism list, that is absolutely ridiculous, because Cuba has been a victim of terrorism rather than a sponsor of terrorism. But this is something that Donald Trump did in his last days of office, and Biden could have changed it with the stroke of a pen the week he came into office, and instead has kept Cuba on that list, which means Cuba has a horrible time trying to have any kind of financial transactions because the banks don't want to work with them. It is the number one problem that Cuba faces right now, and that's why it's so important, a campaign that many groups are doing, including Code Pink, to try to take Cuba off the terrorist list.
Latin America, our neighbor to the south, or as Secretary of War Henry Stimson said in 1945, he described the hemisphere as, quote, our little region over here, which has never bothered anybody. Well, 2023 marks the 200th anniversary of the Monroe Doctrine. And since then, Latin America has endured U.S. invasions, occupations, coups, assassinations, embargoes, and sanctions. And among Latin American countries, as you alluded to, Cuba ranks very high on that list of being targeted by the U.S. 61 years and counting of the U.S. blockade of Cuba can only be described as insane. It serves no U.S. geopolitical interest. It be solely attributed to the power of this small lobby that you refer to. It doesn't even serve a capitalist interest. I bet the business class would love to get into Cuba and have partnerships in some of those luxury hotels that Spain and Canada and maybe some other countries have engaged with the Cuban government with.
The diasporas in some of these countries, like the Venezuelan Americans, like the Cuban Americans, like the Colombian Americans, they tend to be more conservative people who came to this country because they disliked changes in their countries. There were oftentimes changes that were governments in power that were good for the people. And yet we see in Latin America today a vibrant, vibrant continent in which there are countries that are coming to power that are progressive, that are pushed forward by the civil society, and that are representing in many ways the desire to reflect the needs of their people and not the needs of their neighbor to the north. This is, of course, something that the U.S. has been trying to fight against for many, many years, but is in a position now where Latin America is strong enough to create their own institutions like CELAC, which is an institution that is gaining power and will possibly be replacing the Organization of American States that is very much dominated by the United States and by conservative interests. So we see a changing Latin America, and I think it's a very positive thing.
But what does it mean to be a leftist in Latin America today? We're not talking about, you know, Che Guevara-type led guerrilla movements. It's quite different.
Well, there are very strong civil society groups in Latin America. There's very strong women's groups that are still fighting in some countries, very conservative Catholic mores that include a ban on abortions. There are countries in Central America where women are in prison because they have had miscarriages. So the strong women's groups that are also fighting domestic violence issues. There are strong groups that are fighting the dominance of corporations like the mining companies, companies that are taking away the access of communities to their water rights. There are strong groups that are fighting for land reform, access to government resources. You see groups like the MST, the Landless Movement in Brazil, that's an extremely strong movement that helped to propel President Lula back into power. But, you know, these movements are very interesting because while they push forward progressive leaders, they also try to maintain their independence. And you see in Colombia right now the extraordinary new government that's in place. And this was the strongest ally of the United States, where the U.S. has its military bases, and coming to power of a progressive government there, not only the president, Petro, but the vice president, Francia Marquez, who is somebody from the Afro-Colombian community, who was fighting against the mines, a water protector, somebody involved in negotiations with the rebel groups. I mean, it is a tremendous shot in the arm for the entire Afro community throughout Latin America to have somebody like her as vice president. So these are major changes that we're seeing in Latin America that inspire the grassroots in those countries.
Would you include in that group of progressive leaders Andrés Manuel López Obrador, also usually known by his initials AMLO?
I think AMLO is quite extraordinary. And while there are people who criticize the domestic policies and, of course, the policies that he has had around migration in terms of going along with the United States and trying to keep migrants from crossing into the U.S. border to get the asylum that they rightfully deserve, in terms of foreign policy, he has been quite extraordinary. I mean, he has been a leader in pushing for the strengthening of CELAC as an organization that represents Latin America, not the United States. He has been somebody who's come out with issues like supporting Julian Assange and has hosted the brother and the father of Julian Assange in Mexico City. He is somebody that has come out very strongly against the U.S. sanctions on Cuba and says that he wants to create a campaign to get Cuba off of that terrorist list. And so in foreign policy issues, I think he's quite extraordinary. He's also come out and said that he wants to be involved in trying to find a solution to the war in Ukraine and has put forward other leaders to be part of a team. One other thing about the head who is known with the initials AMLO is that he talks to his people every single day. He holds press conferences that last at least 2 hours, Monday through Friday, and takes any question, not like the United States where it's predetermined who's going to ask a question to President Biden and what the question will be. These are really open forums. Hundreds of thousands of people listen to these every single day. When I ever have time, I like to tune into them because it's just beautiful. It's just kind of free-flowing conversation that happens with your leader for 2 hours a day. Imagine if Joe Biden would do that all the times he'd put his foot in his mouth. But in the case of Mexico, and there is now a right-wing campaign in the United States against him. And one of the things they say against him is that he's such a demagogue. He talks for over 2 hours a day to his people. I thought that was quite amusing. But I think he is an extraordinary leader in a country that has so much pressure from the United States.
And how about Alberto Fernandez in Argentina and Gabriel Boric in Chile?
You know, well, these are leaders that aren't like rah-rah leftist leaders, but they are progressives, and they are part of a progressive movement in Latin America. And I think that we should see that Latin America today has many different levels of, you know, which are countries that are straightforward socialist countries like Cuba, and which are countries that would consider themselves more along the progressive line and don't want to be dominated by the United States. And I think that's something that unites a lot of countries in Latin America today. And when you look back at that summit of the Americas that Biden had in Los Angeles last year and see that so many countries stood up and said, if you're not inviting all of Latin America, we're not going to come either. And that's what the president of Mexico started. And then other countries started saying, we're not going to come, or use their ability to come, like the head of Argentina came. And he used his time here to say, you have to stop interfering in the affairs of Latin America in a negative way. You have to stop these sanctions that are so harmful. And the hypocrisy of the United States of saying, we want to get to the root causes of migration, and yet continue to have a stranglehold on countries like Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela that make it so difficult for people to feed their families and are indeed part of the root causes that cause so many of them to leave their countries. So these were things that the governments of Latin America have been saying to the U.S., and it's an important role that they're playing, even if they're not socialist governments.
Talk about Xiomara Castro of Honduras, the first woman president of that Central American country, and by the way, the wife of Manuel Zelaya, who was overthrown in a coup. He was democratically elected, overthrown in a coup in 2009. How is she doing in Honduras?
Well, it's very difficult because when there's a change of government at the top level, it doesn't mean there's a change in the national assemblies. Oftentimes, as in the case of Honduras, it's still in the hands of very conservative people who try to trip her up all along the way and make it very difficult to make the kind of transformations that people like Xiomara Castro would like to see. So it is very exciting to have people like her come to power. It is a vindication of the coup against Mel Zelaya. And it is so important for the people in Honduras who are fighting very, very difficult fights for their land rights, for their water rights, and fighting the terrible violence that exists in their communities. So it is inspiring to have a progressive coming to power, but we shouldn't think that is enough to make transformations in countries that are still controlled not only in the national assemblies by conservatives, but also they have the economic power. And it's very, very difficult to wrest away that power from those elites who have had it for so long.
Talking about change and how it happens. I mean, some people advocate for tinkering around the edges, incremental change, you know, one step forward, two steps back, three steps forward, etc., versus fundamental structural change. No more crumbs. We want the bakery.
You know, in this country, I'm starting to think there is going to have to be a really massive uprising in this country against the entire system, because every time we're trying to tinker around the sides, I mean, we get so little. I mean, look at these poor students that get saddled with a debt after they do their part to learn and try to contribute to society by having more knowledge. And then when government of Biden wants to do a little crumb, which is a $10,000 and in some cases $20,000 relief, there is so much backlash. You wonder, you know, can we even get the crumbs these days? The fact that we don't have a healthcare system in this country is something that is so horrific that I just keep thinking at some point there needs to be a real uprising against this system. When will it happen? I don't know. And so in the meantime, I think, yes, we have to fight for those crumbs because real people's lives are in danger and those crumbs can make the difference between life and death for people. I mean, Obamacare, let's face it, did give some healthcare to people who didn't have it. It's certainly not good enough. So we fight for the crumbs in the meantime, but what we want is the whole pie.
It's interesting to see the resistance in France, and particularly these massive demonstrations, not just one Saturday or Sunday afternoon, but day after day, resistance to Macron and his desire to increase the retirement age from 62 to 64.
Don't you wish that we would have that kind of reaction here in this country, where people would not do a Saturday march where we walk around in circles in Washington, D.C. when all of the Congress and the White House are closed up, but we actually did that kind of constant all the time? That's what we need. And I think that's, you know, what the Occupy movement was about. And we need that kind of thing to come back again. I always just wonder, you know, wouldn't it be beautiful if we did an Occupy movement in Washington, D.C., whether it was around an issue of the student debt or the health care for all, and we just don't leave until we get it. And we could easily surround our Congress, and obviously in a very peaceful way, not the way people did it on January 6th. But I think that's the kind of thing that we need, and the French are such an inspiration.
Talk about combating despair and cynicism. And how do you do that? And I just want to quote that great social philosopher, you may know her, Lily Tomlin. She said, no matter how cynical you become, it's never enough to keep up.
I think countering despair is activism. And every time I get a little too cynical and feeling like maybe none of this is the activism is worth it, I actually push myself to get out again. And then I get excited, whether it's going out to a protest, whether it's protesting myself in the halls of Congress, or whether it's going out like I am now on a speaking tour around the issue of Ukraine with my new book. You know, COVID was such a horrible time when so many of us were cloistered away and didn't have that kind of social activity. And we are social animals. So getting out and being with each other again, having these in-depth conversations, talking about new strategies that we can use, it really is activism that puts you in contact with other people who are hopeful, who do believe that we are agents of change, that we can make things better. And certainly it's that kind of community that gives us this impetus to keep going, and we have to surround ourselves with people who are hopeful.
The Canadian artist, poet, singer Leonard Cohen sings in Anthem, "There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." Where do you see those cracks, those openings today?
Well, the last time I was in a hearing in Congress, I heard this conservative Republican questioning very deeply about how long we're going to continue in this fight in Ukraine and where is this leading? And I talked to him afterwards and I said, why were you doing this kind of hard questioning? And he said, I hate war. And he told me that there are many people in his committee that have stocks in the West weapons companies, and that this is a big racket. And I looked him up, and indeed, he's in one of the reddest districts in Tennessee. And here is a guy telling me that he hates war. And it reminded me of another right-wing Republican who, during the Iraq War, was the guy who coined the phrase freedom fries, because the French wouldn't go with us into the war in Iraq. And so he said, we can't have French fries in the cafeteria anymore. We have to have freedom fries. And he, after going to the funerals of the young men in his district that died in the Iraq War, changed his mind and became one of our greatest allies in the fight against the war in Iraq. So those are certainly some cracks, and there's lots of them out there, and we have to look for them and cultivate them.
Langston Hughes, the great African-American poet, wrote a poem called Dreams. Hold fast to dreams, for if dreams die, life is a broken-winged bird that cannot fly. Hold fast to dreams, for when dreams go, life is a barren field, frozen with snow. What are your dreams? Who and what inspires you?
Well, I am very inspired by people who choose different lifestyles, who are trying to build the kind of communities that we want to live in, to reorganize those communities so that we're not dependent on cars, we're not dependent on living in isolated suburbs, that we can show people that life can be really exciting by having communities where everything we need is in a 15-minute walking radius. Redesigning the way we live our lives so that we're not in these isolated nuclear families. You know, I come from the 1970s when we had communes, and I think there's something beautiful about living in community. And I am inspired by young people who are going back to that. I try to live in as much in community as I can. And I'm inspired certainly by the people that I meet all around the world who are facing such desperate situations and yet are dedicating their lives to making the lives of their communities better. So there's always great inspirational people that we can look towards. They don't have to be the leaders of a country. They don't even have to be the leaders of a movement. I think they have to be people who are part of a movement and are giving their lives to making not only their own lives better, but the lives of the people in their community.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, David. Good talking to you.
You were just listening to Medea Benjamin on system change. Medea Benjamin, a co-founder of Code Pink, is a renowned peace activist and social justice advocate. Author of many books, her latest is War in Ukraine. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 37th year. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Medea Benjamin on System Change, and for her book, War in Ukraine, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online, our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Give us a call, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Joni Mitchell, Woodstock.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, BC. This radio is diverse, independent, and always yours. Check us out at cjsf.ca or search CJSF 90.1 FM on SoundCloud.
Build food security in your community. This holiday season, we're thrilled to announce that the SFU Community Free Fridge is available to staff, students, and faculty. The fridge is conveniently located on the first level of the Student Union Building on Burnaby Campus. We encourage all our community members to enjoy the fridge, or better yet, volunteer with friends to clean and stock it. Thank you to the organizations who made this initiative possible, including the SFSS, Embark Sustainability, the Burnaby Primary Care Network, Food Mesh, Burnaby Neighborhood House, SFU Ancillary Services, and SFU's Office of Community Engagement. Visit sfss.ca/news and follow at Burnaby Fridge on Instagram to find out more.
Hello, and welcome.